Accession number 27804, Mr. Ian, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Real 8. Now, we're talking about the unusual armament setup in the Blenheim. Now,
the armament setup in the Blenheim was, in fact, a bomb sight initially, one signal pistol for the observer in the front seat on the right hand side, and one Browning gun which the pilot operated with a push press control, which is out on the starboard wing. And the bomb bay had manually opening doors. When I say manually opening doors, the weight of the bombs opened the doors on the way out, and there was bungee elastic on the doors to slam them shut. True.
Now, we haven't talked much about bomb sites. So what was the bomb site? How did the bomb site work?
Could just finish off
the
armament.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that was the main armament. And then the wing routes inside the wing routes, there was position for flares, reconnaissance flares. Now, the bomb site. The bomb site was what they called, this bomb site was common in the Royal Air Force for training purposes and operational purposes right up to and after the beginning of the Second World War. It's what they called a vector bomb site. It was worked on a triangular velocity principle. You had a horizontal line which projected the course of the aircraft and airspeed along, to which was attached a drift angle set by a wind indicator. That was one leg, that's two legs of the triangle. The third leg of the triangle was in fact the track over the ground. So you had course and airspeed, track and ground speed, and wind speed and direction. That's your triangle. And that was attached to a compass rose, a compass, which, as I said early on, remembering the patter for a free course follow, this is where it was all learned. And you also attached to this, you had a levelling device, which you had a fore and aft and a cross level, so you had knobs to twiddle to level a bomb site as the pilot flew, inverted commas, straight and level at a constant airspeed, which had to be set on the bomb site. Now, these constant airspeeds and directions were true airspeeds and directions, so you had a circular computer which computed them using the barometric pressure and the outside temperatures and all the other ramifications. And your height also had to be computed vis-a-vis, you had to apply the temperature to the height, to the indicated height, 2 degrees for every 1,000 feet. And your temperature outside was somewhere about 50, minus 50. But all these variables had to be eliminated. And this is what the training was all up to.
And I'll come back to it. How good was the vector?
Pardon?
How good was it? How accurate was it?
Well, without blowing one's trumpet, the more experience you gained, the more accurate you became. I'll come to that later on because there is a qualifier. I was gradually gleaning over the period, this early period of my training, all my flying, the intricacies of the bombing, the computing, the getting the pilot to fly straight and level, keeping the red on red, and keeping the target coming down the drift wires and directing the pilot, all this business. And then the other thing about the backside of the bomb site proper was on a vertical shaft which was calibrated for the type of bomb you were using. It had a removable scale. If you were using practice bombs, you put in a practice bomb scale, and it had a forward tilt to cater for the trail angle of the bomb, which, depending on the type of bomb, varied. And you had the foresight, which was connected to the junction of the wind speed indicator. All these. So the idea was you lined up you directed the pilot to get the target coming straight down the long drift wires, as they were called, which were painted black and white with little bobs on them, just to guide you so you could see them. Once you got them tracking down there, so long as they stayed straight and level, you got a reasonable line of sight. The theory was good. The practice was difficult. You needed a lot of experience, because if you rock the aircraft at the critical moment, you've had it, you don't get the right line of sight. But that was subsequently improved with the wartime bomb sight. But from 1938, well, 36 when we started using this thing, there were different marks, but they're all the same principle. The only variation was the were designed for higher speed aircraft, or alternative for coastal.
You said the Blenheim had the Browning. Now, how was
the Browning gun was tucked out on the wing. It had about, it was very high. It was up on a cradle, very high. To get the down thing in and out was a work of art, which you had to learn. But you could do it in the end, and you had to be able to feed it in. We never fired it. I never fired a Browning gun when I was at Hemswell.
What did you think of the Browning at that stage? I mean, it was the replacement for the Lewis in a way, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, we didn't have much experience about it, to be quite frank. We knew about it. We knew the mechanics of it. We had drawings. We could read up about it. And we went through the procedures, and it was only when you started firing them that you realized the technicalities with them. And that didn't come for some time. But firing the other guns were similar. I mean, you had the same... The same things were likely to happen, probably slightly in a different way because of the mechanism. But they didn't have a magazine. They didn't have a magazine like they did have on the Lewis gun. They had a belt feed, which was the same as the Vickers gun. So there was some similarities in that respect. But it was a very good, a very efficient gun, really, the Browning gun, when it worked. We'll have more about that later.
Anything else about that?
There's a big story to my experience.
Anything else about the Blenheim in these early days? Because you got them.
The Blenheim in these early days was very good, very fast. But the technique, the pilot's technique was different. Bearing in mind they all come off biplanes, their approach was a gliding approach, which was natural. But it used to come in at a very great steep angle and with full flap on, and to flare it out and park it on the ground. And no doubt in these days, the pilots were skillful enough at it. We never... The only accident happened after I left the squadron in May. They had an engine cut on takeoff, which is not an uncommon thing. Anyway, engine cut on takeoff, the aircraft ploughed into... a place called Harpswell Hill, was just off the end of the airfield at Hemswell, and the guys were buried in there. There's about eight or nine guys buried in there from Hemswell.
Now, the landing, so they didn't land it as it should have been landed, really.
Well, they didn't know any better. That's the point. This was the biplane. The word had not got around. In fact, there was no pilot's handling notes as we know today. In fact, even the Blenheim Society have great difficulty in producing handling notes. They were all word of mouth written down by some guy. But we were lucky. We had good pilots, and they very soon mastered it in the short time that I had experience with them. The other peculiarity was that the bomb bay doors were manually handled. So when you were loading the bomb racks or bombs, you had to open the doors, and you had a metal stay, which you, like you have in a car bonnet, you hooked into a little hole in the side of the door, which kept the door open, and then stretched the elastic, the bungee elastic, so that when you took the stay away, the doors, if you didn't watch out, they'd give you a nasty, smart smack. But sometimes it was known subsequently, the bombs which opened the doors didn't have enough energy to open them properly, and they hung up and they were held up on the inside of the bays, and they dropped off at wrong times. Very tricky, very tricky. But that followed the experience we gained. I was saying about the bomb racks. The aircraft was designed to carry a 1,000-pound bomb load. That was four 250-pound bombs, and they had devised a marvellous cradle device which clamped onto the bombs on the ground, and it carried the bomb racks, and you assembled the bomb on the bomb racks, and out from the bomb, from above the bomb there, the well of the aircraft, came down a winch, hand-operated winch, and you hooked it onto this rectangular cradle, and two armors, one up top and two below, three. Okay, winch up, and they just turned the handle and winched the bomb. And when they got up inside, they just put two big screw clamps on there to hold the four racks. But the bombs were separated by a separator, which ran the full length of the bomb rack, and which was part of the bomb carriers, which were mobile, and they came up. You had to plug them in subsequently. But it was a very Heath Robinson, and it took us ages to master the technique of how to assemble these things. In the end, I think operationally in the end, they probably did away with them. I don't remember the using them subsequently when we went on operations. We just dropped the bombs free from the carriers. But that was February, March 37, 38, I mentioned earlier on that we're on the PWR posted preliminary warning role for the Middle East. At that period of time, May 1938, the Royal Air Force was expanding again. And not only were they expanding at home, but they were also expanding in the Middle East. So this expansion, inverted commas, the reason for the overseas tour was to reinforce the Middle East, i.e. Heliopolis, Egypt, with three squadrons. And the three squadrons were 80 Squadron, Fighter Squadron, and 211 Squadron, a Blenheim Squadron, Bomber Squadron, hadn't got Blenheims by then, and 113 Squadron, which was at that time flying Audax, but we had some experience with Blenheim. So we were all nominated for overseas posting, and we duly embarked.
And did you know which squadron you were going to go out
with? We were posted from 114 Squadron to 113 Squadron. I was.
144 Squadron.
144. That was my unit. And then when the PWR came up, it was posted to the Middle East, 113 Squadron.
Now.
So, yeah, 113 Squadron, Bicester, 144 Squadron, Hemswell, posted to Middle East, 113 Squadron. That's all it says on the preliminary warning roll. It doesn't say here, but
Did you all go out together, 113 Squadron?
Oh, yeah. When we were posted, we assembled at Grantham. 113 Squadron. The personnel were kitted out. In the preliminary warning process, you were kitted out with overseas kit.
Now, tell me what that was. We're interested. What was your overseas kit?
Well, what was overseas? It comprised of mainly khaki shirts and shorts and slacks. We even had putties, khaki putties to put around our boots, stockings, pith helmet, topi, dark glasses. What else did we have? That's about all we had. Oh, khaki webbing. I think that's about all. PTR. I think we had plimsolls and things like that. We took them most, mainly khaki water bottles and that sort of stuff. So that was our, and the kit bag. Kit bags were marked with two blue bands and your number, rank and name, and it's troop ship, HMT, Lancashire. We went on that. I think it was Lancashire we went to.
Anything else? Did you do anything else at Grantham, you said?
Oh, yeah. Well, all the squadrons were assembled at Grantham. We were there about a week. 211, the personnel only. 211, 113, and 211 113 80 squadron. Oh, getting to know the guys, the new guys in your squadron, picking up with the old guys that you might have known, because the Air Force wasn't all that big in these days. You got to know them. So there I was, AC1, armoured stroke air gunner, posted to 113 squadron, embarking on the HM, the Her Majesty's Troop Ship, Lancashire, departing from Southampton. So they were all trained down to troop trains in these days. A whole train load went down. So you had three squadrons. I suppose you must have had 300 to 400 men going. I don't know how many. Anyway, we were all trained down, complete with kit, down to Southampton, right into the docks in these days. Train went right in, and you got off the train. your kit, I can't remember what we did with our kit. Yeah, the kit was loaded separately, but we had access to the kit while we were on board, I think. And you had your small kit, of course, with you. Anyway, we got aboard this troop ship, and my mother and father and my sister came to wave me off. And the old band playing, Will You Know Come Back Again, and the old line sign and all that stuff, and streamers. Great. But the tour was going to be 5 years. In that, you weren't going for a weekend, you'd gone for a complete 5-year tour. So, and the old band played. Now, we were all on the lower deck, but on the upper deck, or the officers, the first class, of course, there was a series of officers and nursing sisters and devious other people. Didn't mix with them because it was definitely off limits, you know, first class passengers, but yeah, anyway.
What were conditions like on board the
ship? I'll come into that in a minute. Pardon me. Being a senior man, inverted commas, AC1, with a low number, I was nominated as mess orderly for the trip. Well, nobody knew what that was. You didn't volunteer, you were detailed. So I was detailed as mess orderly along with another guy. So what we were responsible for basically was fetching and carrying the meals from the galley to the mess deck, which was literally a below deck table, which was hung from the roof or deck, and it moved moved with the ship's motion, and we were given Dixie for the tea and all the plates and mugs and cutlery and all that stuff. And we had to wash all this lot up after every meal, apart from the fact of fetching the meals and dishing it out to the guys. I was mess orderly for 10 days. I never saw above decks, except in the evening, by about 8 o'clock at night, and only once in daytime was when we were going into Portside Harbour 10 days later. I never worked so physically hard in all my life, and going through the Bay of Biscay and this troop ship, it was diabolical. Everybody was seasick, and you had to struggle up to the galley, and you've got to experience it to appreciate it. The smells that come from a ship's galley are not conducive to dishing up stew and stuff of that ilk.
Were you seasick then?
Yeah, I was rough. I was rough. But the loo or the heads was adjacent to the, not far away from the mess deck, and they were open. They were open type of facilities. But that's where the toilets were, and the heads and the washing up facility. And the guys slept, you slept on hammocks, and that was you got these issued when you got on board. They were diabolical things. Yeah, it was a work of art to get them slung, and then once you got them slung, you had to get into them because they were about head high. It was quite an art to get into them without falling out. Anyway, you soon the old sweats on board soon sorted you. There was a crew, of course, a merchant seaman, taking the mickey most of the time with all these lads. But we were all accommodated in these hammocks. And you had to sling a hammock I think it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I think you were allowed. But you couldn't, because everybody accommodated in the mess. You couldn't really do very much, because the mess deck, which was a long table, athwart ships, i.e. going from port to starboard or starboard to port, it's suspended, with two bench-type seats either side. So all of the guys, probably about 24 or 28 of them, you sat 14 aside. And at one end was the utensils. And so that was the mess deck, and you dished the meals out. And then when they cleared it away, it was the mess yourself and your number two who cleared them away and whipped them off to the galley and got them all cleaned up and put back in. So you couldn't get back on the mess deck from 10 o'clock in the morning to lunchtime, because the captain did his rounds at 10 o'clock. And it was, everything had, the mess orderlies had to stand by their mess decks and be inspected, you know, as well as the gear, and the captain went around with his white gloves. You're in dead trouble if it wasn't. Anyway, you shouldn't learn after the first couple of days. Anyway, the flag, the captain went around, and the CO went around with the captain and the first officers. Anyway, and then you had to vacate the deck until midday, then you went and started the lunch. The lunch was dealt with. They went down and had their lunch. They cleared off up the top deck. The entertainment on the deck was not very much. I think they played Housie in the old days. Eyes down, look in. It was organised by the ship's permanent staff who were military. They were either Army, Navy, or Air Force. I think ours were Army, but we always reckoned there was a great fiddle going on, because you had to pay so much to have a card, and the discipline was pretty fierce in terms of the routine. When you go to a bingo today, it's nothing like. You had nicknames for all the counters, you know. The Air Force, you know, Shiny 10 was 10 Squadron, you know, and things like that. And I had all the names. But anyway, that went on throughout the day. Those who wanted to play played bingo. And then I think a couple of nights a week we had a film show, because open air. I don't think there's. And then we had the crossing of the line ceremony somewhere. Must have been in the Bay of Biscay. You know, where all the old dress up or get dunked. We were excused because we were mess orderlies. But we came and witnessed. I think we saw some of it. Oh, I did see some of it. But that was 10 days. We didn't call it any ports.
So you went through the Med?
Yeah, through Bay of Biscay. We didn't call it a jib. I think we just put into Malta, but we didn't. Nobody went ashore. There was an exchange of something. Ship just pulled into the harbour and then left. And we went across. Oh yes, we went across to Algiers. The same procedure. Didn't go ashore. And then, we didn't. The mess orderlies didn't go ashore. Maybe some of the guys did. And then we went down to Alex and disembarked subsequently.
It was Alex, not Alexander. Portside. Was it Portside?
Yeah,
or Alex?
Yeah. We didn't call it Jib. We passed Jib in the distance. We went to Malta. Alexandria and Malta, Algiers, and
but you
Alex.
Said Portside before. Did you go to
Portside? That's Alexandria.
Portside.
Where we all got off, thank goodness.
Now, what were your first impressions? It's your first really foreign place. What did you think of?
Well, we hadn't got much time to think of. I think it wasn't until we got ashore. It wasn't until we got ashore that we didn't fancy it, because it was. Well, it's dirty for starters, and we didn't understand the language. It all strange. We knew they were all up to us. We were having the mickey taken out of us, and we knew. And the gilly-gilly boys, I always remember the guy with the three cups and the chickens. The gilly-gilly man, have you heard of him? He used to play. Yeah, gilly-gilly. But that was fine. All the three squadrons came adrift and came ashore, and we were trained off to various destinations. In our case, 113 Squadron went to Heliopolis, which is outside Cairo. 211 Squadron went to Helwan, I think, which is also outside Cairo, but another station further over, or to the other south of Cairo. And 80 Squadron, they were taken off to somewhere near Alexandria, Amaria, or somewhere near Alexandria. That was the fighter squadron. So you had the, that was the breakdown. Now, so Juliet arrived, and having said we arrived, we were trained down to the appropriate bases. The aeroplanes, which the squadron had in UK in these days, were all boxed up and put in crates, big boxes, ginormous packing cases, and shipped off at some period prior to our disembarkation. That must have been at least a month or more, because when we got to Heliopolis, we weren't there very long before they were picking up the first aircraft from the MU. They went to Abukir. The aircraft went to Abukir, which is just outside Alexandria. And there they were taking out the packing cases and assembled and test flown, and our pilots went up from Heliopolis to pick them up as they became serviceable. So there we are in July. We got there sometime in May. And in July, I've got here, I don't know what date it was. It must have been the back end. We arrived in May, and it must have been towards the end of May, beginning of June, that we got our aircraft, because I see here that we went off on a detachment to a place called Dekela in June. Let's see what date it says here for accuracy. That was our first detachment as a full squadron. I didn't put the dates down. Well, it's all on the wrong sheets.
That's all right. I mean, I think...
Yeah, there was obviously a small...
Now, what was Heliopolis Airfield
like? Well, they're coming... Where have we got to? We've got ourselves disembarked at the moment. Heliopolis was a big three-squadron base. Pity it doesn't... I've got a photograph of it. Which had a north camp and south camp. North camp and south camp. South camp was the base of 208 Squadron, flying, believe it or not, Odex and Ferry Gordons, big biplanes. And there's a long road which ran north and south, on which the airfield was almost to the northeast of the road. Desert, big desert airfield, flattened. West Camp was 216 Squadron, Transport Squadron, flying Valencias. Self-contained squadron headquarters, hangars. And on the other side was RAF Heliopolis headquarters, the NAFI, and the billets, and 113 Squadron, where we were duly billeted. And not backing onto our quarters, I can show you a photograph, backing onto our quarters, separated by a tennis court width and a fence, was Heliopolis Palace Hotel. It became very famous. And beyond the Palace Hotel was Heliopolis Town. Quite, upmarket sort of place.